Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Bobbi Jean Switzer, professor of anesthesiology at Northwestern University and an associate editor for Anesthesiology. And you are listening to an anesthesiology podcast designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in our journal. Today, we are speaking with authors of publications that appear in the November 2020 issue of the journal. With us is Dr. Graham J. Walkden. Dr. Walkden is one of the authors of an article titled Early Childhood General Anesthesia and Neurodevelopmental Outcomes in the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children Birth Cohort. Dr. Walkden is a registrar in anesthesia at the Bristol Royal Hospital for Children and a Wellcome Trust Clinical Academic Training Doctoral Fellow at the University of Bristol, all in Bristol, United Kingdom. Welcome, Dr. Walkden.
Thank you, and good afternoon from the UK.
And joining Dr. Walkden is Dr. Hannah Gill, the lead clinician on this paper. Dr. Gill is a consultant pediatric anesthetist at the Bristol Royal Hospital for Children and an honorary senior lecturer in the School of Physiology, Pharmacology, and Neuroscience at the University of Bristol, all in Bristol, United Kingdom. Welcome, Dr. Gill.
Hello, thank you for having me.
And joining Drs. Walkden and Gill is Dr. Andrew J. Davidson. Dr. Davidson wrote an accompanying editorial, Anesthesia in Childhood and Neurodevelopmental Outcome, The Ongoing Hunt for a Phenom. Dr. Davidson is professor in the Department of Anesthesia and Pain Management, Royal Children's Hospital, and the Melbourne Children's Trials Center, Murdoch Children's Research Institute, all in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome, Dr. Davidson.
Good evening.
So, Dr. Gill, can you tell us briefly what question or questions you wanted to answer with this study?
Yes, thank you. In animal studies, extended exposures of all the commonly used general anesthetic drugs during early development has been shown to cause the death of brain cells. And some studies have demonstrated long-term cognitive and behavioral changes. In epidemiological studies in humans, there's good evidence that relatively brief exposure to general anesthesia in infancy doesn't result in poorer cognitions shown in early childhood. However, there is mixed and generally poor evidence of an association between early exposure to anesthesia and poorer cognitive outcomes in later childhood, and for a range of other neurodevelopmental or behavioral outcomes. In this study, we aim to determine whether general anesthesia for surgical procedures before the age of 4 years was associated with a range of adverse neurodevelopmental outcomes in older children using an existing birth cohort.
Dr. Davidson, there have been many studies trying to address this loaded issue of whether anesthesia in young children is associated with long-term developmental issues. Can you briefly tell us what we already know about this topic?
It's a very confusing area, and it's not at all clear what exactly is going on. As Dr. Gill said, there are numerous studies which have been done in humans. Some show evidence for an association between anesthesia and surgery, and it's important to say it's not just anesthesia, it's the fact that these children are having something else done at the same time. So anesthesia and surgery, some evidence for poorer performance at school in some studies, but not others. Some evidence in some studies that children have learning problems or behavioral problems, but not in all studies. And some studies which show that the children have increased risk of specific deficits in some neurodevelopmental domains. But once again, it's patchy and it's not particularly consistent across all the different studies that have been done.
Dr. Walkden, can you tell us about the methodology of this study?
Yes. So this was a large cohort study that was concerned with long-term neurotoxic effects of general anesthesia in early childhood. And it used data that was collected as part of an existing birth cohort called the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children, which is based in the United Kingdom.
Dr. Gill, can you tell us a bit more about what the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children is about?
So it's a cohort based at the University of Bristol, and the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children is also known as the ALSPAC study for short, or locally referred to as the Children of the 90s. And it's a world-leading birth cohort study, including 14,000 pregnant women who were recruited between April 1991 and December 1992. And those pregnant women's partners and the children arising from those pregnancies have been followed up very intensively over the last two decades. And it provides the international research community with a very rich resource for the study of the environmental and genetic factors that affect a person's health and development throughout life.
Dr. Davidson, you used the word phenome in the title of your editorial. I am not sure how many of our listeners are familiar with this term. I personally looked up the definition. Can you help us understand?
Well, strictly speaking, it was perhaps not the best term to use, but the concept is that in the animal studies, there's evidence that if you give a young animal enough general anesthetic, it seems to have some sort of toxic effect on the developing brain. So if there was a degree of so-called anesthetic neurotoxicity, you'd think, well, maybe that must manifest itself somehow in humans. And the way that such a toxicity or such a defect or something which is a sort of biological cause is then reflected clinically is sometimes referred to as something like a phenome. So if there's evidence that anesthetics are, quote, toxic to the developing brain, then you'd expect at some stage to see some sort of effect in neurodevelopment in humans. So the sort of hunt for the phenome is this slightly backward idea, if you like, that there's evidence for toxicity in the laboratory, therefore they're hunting for how would that evidence potentially manifest itself in humans, hence the phenome. And it's important to note that this research is slightly backwards because normally we identify a problem in humans and then we go to the laboratory to try and identify what is the cause of the problem. Whereas here, we've identified a problem in the laboratory and then we're checking to see if the problem is actually manifested in humans, hence the term hunting for the phenome or hunting for a particular aspect of toxicity which we might find in humans.
That makes perfect sense now. So, Dr. Walkden, can you tell us more about details of how you conducted this study? How many children did you include and how long was the follow-up?
The study included 13,400 children. And we grouped them into having had zero, one, or multiple general anesthetics to enable a surgical procedure by the age of four. Children had been followed up using a wide array of neurodevelopmental assessments, which were measured between the ages of 7 and 16 years old. When we looked for differences between groups in these assessments in order to estimate the association between early childhood general anesthesia and surgery and their long-term neurodevelopmental outcome, we controlled for a rich description of confounding factors and used statistical techniques that addressed participant dropout and mitigated against finding false positive results that you might expect when you analyze so many outcomes.
Did you have information on the pregnancies and what did you know about the parents?
Yes, we were fortunate to have a rich description of the children, their environments, households, and the parents. Which we were able to control for confounding factors. A great deal of information about the pregnancies themselves had been coded from healthcare records by midwives, and this meant that we were able to account for the mother's age, her health status, and any hospitalizations during the pregnancy, or, for example, whether additional testing for fetal anomalies had been performed. Regarding the parents, we used data concerning their socioeconomic positions, such as occupation or educational achievement and income. A wealth of other information, such as the maternal cognitive performance and in utero exposure to smoking, alcohol, and illicit substances were also analyzed.
This does seem like a somewhat unique and very rich base of information to draw upon. Dr. Davidson, are there any comparable registries to this Avon longitudinal cohort? And if so, have any of them been used to look at this issue of anesthesia and neurodevelopment?
There are a number of quite large, high-quality birth cohorts in the world, a couple in the UK. I think the other one in the UK that's well-known is Born in Bradford. There are some in the Netherlands and some in Scandinavia. And there's one in Western Australia, in Perth, which is called the Rainey Birth Cohort, which a group from Perth and New York have investigated to try and see if there's an association between anesthesia and surgery in early childhood and later neurodevelopmental problems. They found there were some associations in some domains, but not in other domains. But the domains that they found associations in were not exactly congruent with what was found in the Avon birth cohort.
Dr. Gill, as I recall, there were many neurodevelopment outcomes and various methods and tests to assess these outcomes. Can you provide us with a few examples of the key issues you looked at?
We looked at motor, cognitive, linguistic, educational, social, and behavioral developmental outcomes. And we were able to look at those between the ages of 7 years and 16 years. Some of that was assessed using school examination results. Many were validated by parent or teacher questionnaires, and the children and their families underwent clinical assessments at various points through the follow-up.
So, Dr. Walkden, what did you find?
Well, reassuringly, we found that general anesthesia and surgery performed before the age of four were not associated with a global picture of neurodevelopmental impairment when measured in older childhood. And that is to say that we found little evidence of a statistically and clinically significant reduction in performance in a wide array of assessments in the areas that Dr. Gill just mentioned.
Did you find any areas that appear to be associated with adverse consequences with an early exposure to anesthesia?
Yes, we found that anesthesia and surgery were associated with reduced balance and manual dexterity at 8 years old, and also with reduced social communication ability at 10 years old. The odds of a clinically significant impairment in a child's ability to communicate within a social group was increased by 50% after one exposure and by 260% after multiple exposures to general anesthesia and surgery.
Dr. Davidson, what is different about Drs. Gill and Walkden's study from all the previous ones or not, and either in the execution or the findings?
The strengths of the study are the size of the study and the depth and the quality of the neurodevelopmental assessments that were done. The other strength is that they were often done in, usually done in older children, and children, if they have a deficit, tend to grow into the deficit. So it becomes more apparent. If you get an injury in early childhood, then the consequences of that injury tend to become more apparent the older you are, because it's like a sandcastle. If the foundations aren't good, then the bigger the sandcastle, the more it is, it's going to fall over. So assessing children when they're older is more likely to find a clinically significant deficit. And there are subtle aspects of neurodevelopment which you can drill down in older children rather than younger ones. So the strength of their study was the size, the fact that they were looking at older children, and the depth and breadth of the assessments and the quality assessments that were done.
So Dr. Walkden, were there circumstances other than anesthesia and surgery exposures that you found in this cohort that were associated with worse development outcomes?
Yes, we found that neurodevelopmental outcomes were generally worse for male children. For children born to parents with lower educational achievement, for those born to younger mothers, those who experienced a more complex course postnatally, meaning a prolonged stay in hospital after birth or involving transfer to a specialist neonatal unit. Outcomes were also generally worse in children who experienced more traumatic life events, such as parental divorce or being bullied in school, and also in children whose mothers were reporting that they were unwell during the pregnancy.
So, Dr. Davidson, as you alluded to, it seems that we have a lot of different studies and meta-analyses on this topic that do not all agree. Is there an explanation for this?
There's no single explanation, but there are a number of possible explanations. The simplest is that many of these studies look at multiple outcomes, and so there's always an increased risk of type 1 error or finding something purely by chance because you look in so many different domains. In Dr. Walkden's study, they carefully adjusted for that and reduced that risk. The second is that we tend to dichotomize our outcomes into finding something or not finding something, and if using an arbitrary p-value cutoff, which means that if you do multiple different studies and the population varies slightly, then mathematically you're going to find that some do find something and some don't find something because of the chance variation between studies. If you look at it biologically, and if you assume that there is some toxicity which is manifested in humans, then the way humans develop, the consequences of a brain insult depend very much on the type of the insult, the age of the insult, and the extent of the insult. But then they're also influenced by the environment and the genes. And depending on what that mix, you get a different type of outcome. So if anesthetics, that's a big if, were to have some sort of toxicity in humans, then you might actually expect the outcome to vary depending on when the child had the anesthetic and their genetic makeup and their environmental makeup. So it could be all these studies are slightly different in the timing of the anesthetic and they're slightly different populations, so therefore perhaps you would expect to see slightly different results in each study.
So, Dr. Walkden, did you have information on the trajectory of neurodevelopment of these kids before the anesthetic exposures?
In a word, no. We looked at neurodevelopmental outcomes which were measured after the child reached 6 years of age in order to deliberately focus on long-term neurotoxic effects from anesthesia and surgery and to avoid any overlap with short-term cognitive behavioral changes in the post-operative period and the months that followed.
I know you used the terms social communication earlier in this conversation and also in the paper pragmatic communication to describe the areas where there were deficits found in those children who were previously exposed to anesthesia. What exactly do these terms mean, and are they different or not from just, I guess, simple communication?
The social use of language encompasses a range of linguistic skills which children increasingly rely on as they grow older in order to communicate and socially interact with others. It includes what are termed pragmatic aspects of verbal communication. These are intelligibility and fluency of speech, the correct use of syntax, inappropriate initiation of a conversation, the coherence and context of their speech, and any use of stereotyped conversation or scripted language, as well as the development of conversational rapport. All of those skills are quite sophisticated and nuanced aspects of communication which emerge in older children, and they're very distinct from language fundamentals or simple communication skills, such as spelling, vocabulary, and word reading ability, which are much easier to test and can be tested at younger ages.
So what do you think the limitations of your study were?
Well, there are three main limitations to bear in mind with our work. Firstly, it analyzed data from a birth cohort, which we heard about, ALSPAC, which was not designed to record detailed information about the anesthesia and surgery. So the information that we used in the study is not validated against healthcare records. Secondly, whilst we made careful adjustments for a rich set of confounding factors, you have to remember that this is an observational study. Residual confounding may in part explain our findings concerning impaired motor function and social communication ability following early childhood anesthesia and surgery. And thirdly, it should be borne in mind that the children in the cohort, as I mentioned, were exposed to general anesthesia between 1991 and 1997. And since then, changes in anesthetic clinical practice are likely to have enhanced the delivery of anesthetic care.
Dr. Davidson, I think you write in your editorial that no single study is ever likely to answer the dilemma of whether anesthesia is associated with neurodevelopmental problems. That sounds rather pessimistic. Can you tell us why you believe this?
Firstly, philosophically, I'm a great believer that science is incredibly complex, and particular clinical science, and that no single study or some single trial ever really proves something. I know that's sort of heresy as an editor for the journal, but the reality is things are complicated and there's always a degree of imprecision or uncertainty in the estimates and the observations that we make and our assumptions that we make about the causation. In this particular issue, there is the complexity of we don't really know what we're looking for. And it's very difficult to translate the laboratory findings into what we would expect to see in humans. Even the primate findings, it's hard to know what they mean and how they translate. So if we don't really know what we're looking for, then it's very hard to exclude everything. We simply don't have the resources or the number of studies to say we can exclude every single possibility that any duration of anesthetic at any particular age caused any particular neurodevelopmental issue. So it's almost impossible to rule out neurotoxicity. But then, as Dr. Walton alluded to, if we actually find evidence for an association, we yet then have the problem that it's very plausible it's just due to confounding factors. And the kids have a anesthetic for a particular reason, and they're all different. So we're sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't keep doing the studies, because for me, clinical research is a bit like a Monet painting. And you, rather than having a single colour across the whole canvas, each study is like one little daub of paint. And it's the overall synthesis of all the paint which actually makes you figure out what's going on. And so that's why I think these studies are important, not because they provide the whole canvas, but they provide one little daub of paint to help us try and understand exactly what's going on.
That was an excellent explanation. Dr. Gill, we haven't forgotten about you. I hope you're still there. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently issued a caution against lengthy or repeated general anesthetics in children younger than 3 years of age and during the third trimester of pregnancy. Do you believe this is warranted?
So I think this is a very important question. The FDA warning states that healthcare professionals should balance the benefits of appropriate anesthesia against the potential risks. And I don't think that anyone can really criticize that as a piece of advice or as a warning. Lengthy or repeated surgery in young children is very thankfully not particularly common, and that type of surgery, at least in my experience, is never undertaken lightly. We know that exposure to pain and stress during early development leads to lifelong neurobehavioral changes, and appropriate anesthesia and analgesia is necessary because of that reason. The joint professional guidance from the UK bodies, the APA, GBI, the Royal College, the Association of Anesthesia and the College of Anaesthetists of Ireland, released guidance to suggest that a discussion of the potential influence of infant anesthesia on long-term cognitive development is not mandatory at a preoperative consultation. And I find that in my practice in the UK, I'm very rarely asked by parents about the problem. I think that's possibly different in the US. So in summary, I don't really understand the politics of the FDA warning in the US, but I don't think anyone can really criticize it because it's just asking us to be careful.
Dr. Davidson, what would you tell parents if they ask you about whether there are any concerns of their child having anesthesia?
What would I tell the parents? I don't bring it up unless parents bring it up. If parents do bring up the issue, then I think they're reasonably comfortable with the issue. They're familiar with the idea that all during pregnancy they have avoided unnecessary drugs because you don't know what's happening to the fetus. And this concept of drugs or having an insult like surgery has some sort of impact on the development of the child, I don't think parents find a particularly foreign or challenging idea. And if you raise it with them and say, look, it's possible, but we don't really know, and the evidence is fairly mixed, and we're certainly not definite that there is a problem. But then, as Dr. Gill said, if you then turn around and say the consequences of not having the surgery and the anaesthetic are far more concrete and are much, much greater concern, then parents tend to get it. And I haven't found many parents that actually find it a particular issue.
Dr. Gill, do you have other projects planned or in progress to help enlighten us on the safety of anesthesia or specific aspects of anesthesia? Or what do you propose needs to be done next?
We hope to possibly continue our collaboration with the LSPAC study in that the linkage across to the actual healthcare records will hopefully become available as digitalization and cross-communication improves. In the laboratory in Bristol, we're going to carry on focusing to try and improve rodent models of general anesthesia during early development as they remain key to innovation in this area. In the clinical setting, randomized trials like the GAS study are still needed, but they need to be large like the GAS study was and multi-center. And they will always be restricted to specific outcomes in specific populations of children. And long-term follow-up in those children is incredibly challenging, especially to get it funded. We continue to hope that we might be able to study the effects of novel agents such as Xenon in possibly our oral cleft patients. They're a group of patients who undergo multiple surgeries in infancy, and they have long-term speech and language assessments as standard care in the UK. And provide a potentially valuable source for the future. So we have a few areas that we hope to continue to work in.
Well, that sounds very promising, and thank you for your continued work in this area. I hope today's discussion will interest many of our listeners and lead you to read this important article and editorial to learn more. Thank you, Drs. Walton, Gill, and Davidson, for discussing your work with us today. I wish you well as you continue your efforts to enhance the practice of anesthesiology and strive to improve the care of our patients.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.